without Caesar being around. I mean, all of us had this vision that Caesar would be here for another 20, 30 years, 40 years. I mean, who knows? His dad lived to be 100, 101, I think it was, and his mom lived to be 100 years old. And we were just automatically assumed, because Caesar took such good care of himself and so forth, that he was going to be doing the same thing. So that, no, I mean, it was just a question of, I mean, I personally wanted to take every opportunity I had to learn everything I could and to be a part of in any particular way that I could be of service to him and help in any way that he thought that I would be beneficial towards him. But no, I don't think any of us knew or felt that or understood that or believed that. Or maybe we just couldn't see the signs.
Do you think it was an issue for him? I mean, obviously, he expected to live a long time, but did he ever discuss with you the issue of how the union would be run when he was gone? Or was that something that he devoted thought to, do you think?
No, we never really talked about that. And, you know, he would just share with us what his visions were. And I think that was his way of always keeping us thinking about what the future would be of the organization. So he talked about radio stations, he talked about credit unions, he talked about the housing program and about cooperatives and about management. I mean, he spent a lot of time with us on the whole area of management and how important and how critical that was to our future success within the organization. And he literally, I mean, we knew when he felt something was very important because he would spend his time and energy there with us and make sure that we all went through this together. And I think it was more in terms of he knew that at some day when he was not going to be here, that it was going to take a strong team to keep this organization alive and functioning in the way that he had set it going for us. And so I think he was always trying to develop all of us and trying to bring us up and trying to give us the vision and the creativity that he had. Even though we'll never match that, we'll certainly try to learn from his experience and learn from the example that he gave us to do the best that we possibly can.
Because you're responsible now, and your goal is certainly never to replace him or to try and act as he would act. You have to somehow take what he did and do something else with it.
That's right. I mean, nobody will ever replace Cesar Chavez. Cesar. I mean, he was unique. He was a real heroic figure of our times. He was a real prophet among us. And our goal and our mission is to take what he left us, that foundation that he built for us, and continue to develop it in the best way, in the fastest way we possibly can, in a way that we know that he would have wanted to see this organization go towards the future. I mean, it was a dream of building a strong, democratic, national organization for farm workers, one that farm workers would have a tremendous amount of participation and responsibility for really bringing about change. And at the same time, we not only think about ourselves, but we do something for the community at large. And that's why I think the issue of food safety was always such a major motivating force behind him and behind the movement, because that was something that we could do not only for the farmworker community, but that's something that we could do for the community at large. We have that responsibility, since we're so close with the food in the processing of food and so forth, to really make sure that it's safely produced for people so it won't have a negative impact on people's health or on the environment or the world around us.
So all these threads and chains were in place and were going forward, and then all of a sudden Caesar wasn't there. Could you just switch gears and tell me what that meant to you when you learned that all of a sudden the focal point, the key in all this was no longer there?
Well, when I'd talked to Caesar the day before he'd passed away on that evening, it was a Thursday night, and I was in Phoenix, Arizona, on the way to meet him the next morning so that we could begin traveling back to the East Coast and continue to promote the campaign. At that particular time, we were in the Bruce Church trial and promote the Great Boycott and so forth. And when I spoke with him, he just, you know, we talked for a few minutes, and he just said he was very tired. And it wasn't anything unusual, because he oftentimes, I mean, you knew by nighttime that he'd spent a lot of time during the day. He'd gotten up very early in the morning, and that he would feel that way. And so as I look back at it and I think about those few moments that we had on the phone together, I mean, he really said, I'm very tired, Art. I'm very tired. And so then the next day, we left early in the morning with some supporters, and we were driving from Phoenix, Arizona to San Luis to meet him there that particular day. And Jose and I were talking in the car, and we had Radio Campesino on the air because of our station in Phoenix. And as we were listening to it, all of a sudden, I heard some real sad music come out on the radio. And we had the radio turned down kind of low because we were talking to one another. And I asked him to turn it up right away. And I kind of caught, and he caught something to say that Cesar was sick. And so we listened, and we sped up to go even faster because we were in the middle of the desert at that point, and we weren't near any phones. And so Jose started driving as fast as he could, and so we get to a phone, and then the next thing that we heard on the radio, after there was a short interruption in the music, that he had died. And still today, it's difficult to think that Caesar's not here with us. It was, couldn't believe it, that he was no longer alive, that he would no longer be with us here physically, that you wouldn't walk into his office and see him there, that we wouldn't be making those trips together, that he wouldn't be there to talk to and to discuss strategy with and to talk about the next organizing campaign and what we needed to do. And immediately when we got to a phone, we called La Paz to find out what was happening. And we talked to Paul, and I talked to my wife Lou and to Helen, and it was true. He had passed away. And so we drove as fast as we could to get to Yuma, and where he had been taken at that point. And we got there within about an hour and a half. And immediately we began talking to Paul and to the family and about making the arrangements to get him back and working that particular part of it out. And so I remember going to see him there. We had him in a waiting room, and already there was a lot of people that were gathered around that had heard something on the news. And a lot of press was there and wanted our reactions and so forth. And the only thing that we could think about at that point was the fact that just Caesar wasn't there with us. And I flew back with him in the plane to go back to come here to Bakersfield so we could begin making the plans for his funeral and for all those arrangements that need to be made. But it was, it's a moment that I'll never forget within my life, and I'm just so grateful to God that I did get a chance to spend so much time with him, and that I did get a chance to share a big part of my life with him and learn from him and see somebody in action who really believed in bringing about dignity and respect for people, whether it be farm workers or whether it be Chicanos or whether it be Latinos or African Americans. He really truly believed that. And I know that from my own personal experience with him, and it's just, it was a great part of my life, and it always will be.
Something's happened since Caesar died that's truly remarkable. I don't know if it was known, expected him to die, but he believed in sacrifice and that motivated. And somehow his passing seems to have re-energized people and in many ways that it's created, you know, it's brought people back in touch with positive forces and set a lot of positive things going. And it seems like the union is being reborn again now. It's in some way triggered by his passing and that's effect on people.
Caesar, I guess he never stops organizing.
No, the last campaign.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 17. We're going to camera roll 18. Our next take will be take 8.
Camera roll 18, sound roll 8, take 8.
She's leaving the room. I guess I'd like to end the interview by having you talk a little bit about, I think, for lack of a better word, the spiritual and practical rebirth of the union after Caesar's death, how it's affected what you and everyone else does now, and how that's led to new energy and new successes.
Yeah, I guess with Caesar's passing, I mean, what's taken place in many of us, and myself included, is that, I mean, it was like a real awakening to us. I mean, in the sense that here's Caesar, who had given his entire life, had given every ounce of strength that he possibly had.
You got it.
Yes. Okay, this is
take 9.
Let's start over again and I'd like your thoughts about this process of rebirth, what the positive things that came out of losing someone like Caesar.
I think, you know, Caesar's passing has had a tremendous impact on all of us, and myself included, in that, you know, it was an awakening for us all, and Caesar had given us and devoted his entire life towards this movement, towards bringing about change for farm workers. And we were there, and we were all a part of it, and we were given, we thought, you know, everything we possibly could. But then after he passed away, I really realized that, gosh, you know, I really didn't do what I should have been doing, or I really didn't give enough of what I could have given. And as a result, we now feel and sense that deep commitment that needs to be there. I mean, you really sense that fire in the gut that has to be there to drive you to make sure that you not only accomplish what you want to accomplish, but you accomplish the bigger vision in terms of what Caesar had always talked to us about what the movement, what we're trying to accomplish here among farm workers and among Latinos and so forth. And so as a result, it has given us a new spirit, a new beginning. And when we planned to celebrate his first anniversary this last year, I mean, we wanted to do it in such a way that it would allow people that were having the same sense of feeling to become a part, to participate in it. And so it was actually the farm workers that inspired us in a lot of ways to say that, hey, let's do something very big, very dramatic that, again, allows people to become a part of what we're doing. And so as a result, the peregrinación from Delano to Sacramento, yes, it was a reenactment of what was done in 1966 in the early days of the movement, but at the same time, it was very important because it was a way for people to recommit themselves. It was a way for folks to come and once again demonstrate their support and their commitment towards the farm worker movement. And so even from the first day when we started, although all of us were very nervous inside that what if we have this peregrinación, then nobody comes to it. But even at the first days, I mean, already it created the energy that needed to be created as a result of it. And hundreds of farm workers came on Holy Thursday and left work and came to be a part of that. And they marched with us all along the way. We thought once we start to get outside of Delano that there'd be a big drop-off, and yet they continued with us all the way to Rich Grove that first night. And we got to Rich Grove, and there the farm workers really kind of set the stage for the whole peregrinación when they had a hall already there, all decorated up and everything, and they had organized people within the community there to donate food, and so they brought all the beans and tortillas and rice and whatever drink there to feed everybody that was participating in the event. We had a big meeting there that night and a big rally there that night, and then everybody went to sleep in people's homes. And that kind of set the stage, because from there on, that's how the peregrinación went every night. You start off in the morning with the Mass, and Father Salandini led the Mass, and then you would start going, and we would announce that a certain place would be stopping for lunch, and people would come to join us for lunch and bring food and things of that nature, and drink and so forth, and go to that night and find a place to meet at. And literally, I mean, it was like a circus coming to town. I mean, people would be outside on the sidewalks, and they'd come and join us in the march, and they would join us at the meeting, and they would be there at the rally, and they would bring food and take us to their homes to sleep and so forth. And so it was a real reawakening, a real rejuvenation. And that triggered, as a result of that, a whole series of elections that began in May of last year. And since then, now we've won 11 elections over this period of time. It's covering almost 4,000 workers. And it's even taken us outside the state of California into Washington State, where we just won the first election for farm workers ever in the state of Washington. And so it's continuing to create that energy and giving people that sense of hope that we all need if we're going to continue in this effort to bring about justice for farm workers, so that even in Caesar's passing, he's continued to motivate us. He's continued to organize us in the sense that we're doing what needs to be done to bring about change. We got this past year, Dolores Huerta, our co-founder, was the person that really took one of our major victories last year and turned it into a successful contract for us. Unbelievable. I mean, here it was, an election that we won on December 16th of 1994, and by March 17th, 1995, Dolores had negotiated the agreement with Bear Creek Production Company, the largest rose company in the entire nation, negotiated that agreement and got a contract for us, and within a three-month period. Now, within labor, that's unheard of, but also within our movement, within the farmworker efforts, again, that's a historic thing to make happen. And so Dolores did a tremendous job, the workers did a tremendous job, but also I think Caesar's passing also motivated those employers that got them to the point where they said, look, the farmworkers have won this election fair and square, so we're going to do our part now, and we're going to sit down and bargain in good faith. And a lot of credit goes to their president, Bill Williams, for making that decision to do that. So as a result, I think it's a sign of what's taking place here. We were just alerted yesterday, in fact, that the Chateau Saint Michel management, their management has made a decision to sit down and bargain with us in good faith and not to fight us any longer. And even to sit down and work out a joint letter with us to go to the workers and saying, look, there's no fears that should be among anybody. Whether you supported the union or you didn't support the union during the election campaign, at this point, we've made a decision to recognize the union, and we're going to sit down and bargain with them in good faith. I mean, that's not necessarily that common within labor today, and yet it's happening with us. So that I think Caesar's spirit very much continues not only to motivate us, to motivate me personally, but also impacts even on those that may be opposed to us and has an impact on them and points to them in terms of their responsibility also towards their workers.
Last question I want to ask. One of Caesar's favorite dichos was, "I must tiempo que vida." What does that dicho mean to you?
Well, I know Caesar always said that. And
would you say what I know Caesar always
said? I know Cesar always said, I must tiempo que vida.
Una vez más.
Okay. I know Cesar always said that there was hay más tiempo que vida, and that was a favorite saying of his. But I don't know, you know, I feel a certain urgency. I mean, gosh, you know, we never expected that Caesar would leave us, and yet he did, and very much sooner than what we ever expected. So I think all of us feel a sense of urgency that even though there is more time than life, that we do have a responsibility to do as much as we can. And to capture this period in our lives when people are feeling a sense of rejuvenation, feeling a sense of recommitment, and do everything we possibly can within this period, this window of opportunity, to take forward the union and to complete the vision that Caesar had set for us in terms of creating this national democratic union for farmworkers. So as a result, we're doing everything we possibly can, and we're driving the organization, we're driving ourselves as as hard as we can so that we can be as successful as we can and be proud of the work that we're doing and bring about that dignity and justice for farm workers and really fulfill our mission.
Thank you. I think that's all there is to say. We just said that. I'm not convinced we have enough wide shots. Should we pull the mic up? Or do you,
we need some room time.
We need room time. We need some room time. Just sit still for a minute. Let me leave the lights on. I need to.
Okay, if everybody can quiet with me, you'll figure it out.
Okay, this is room tone for the interview with Art.
Quiet, please.
Well, I guess you don't want those clicks. Roll in.
Take one.
Actually, this is an interview with Dolores Huerta on June 9th, La Paz. Before we start the interview, could you just say one line that we'll need to establish? You just say, I was born in Dawson, New Mexico in 1930.
I was born in Dawson, New Mexico in 1930.
And we'll use that with some family picture. Mm-hmm. Let's start out talking about things that happened when you were young that sort of influenced you, that shaped who you are. I guess you were really young in New Mexico, but the years in Stockton, your mother, I read at one point, had been in a Yucapawa strike, and your father had been a labor activist, and your stepfather was a bracero. So were all these factors that sort of made you aware and made you concerned or want to do things, or where do you trace that impulse in your life?
I don't know where to start. I think probably when I was young, I was my mother always kind of pushed me to be active in different things. You know, I was a Girl Scout from the time I was 8 to the time I was 18. I used to like to read a lot. And, you know, when you're young and you read, you always read about, you know, the hero and, you know, the evil people. And when I became a teenager, I especially was subjected to racial discrimination, you know, once we started going to high school. And when you start becoming aware of the injustices that occur when your friends get arrested and you see other people doing things worse than they do and they don't get arrested. And seeing how the school discriminated against the kids of color and the poor white kids also. And the rich kids always got like really special treatment in our high school. So I think that's when I first started being aware of injustices, you know, that happen. My mother was always, she was a very religious person and always a very charitable individual. She always was always helping people whenever she could. We always had people staying at our house, different people that needed a place to stay, that were having through some hardship or the other. So our culture, I mean, growing up with my mother, was that you were supposed to help people if you could. And that was part of being a human being, is if there was any way that you could help someone, you did that. And the other thing is that you were not supposed to talk about what you did, because if you did, then that removed the grace for that good deed, you know. And I guess the word in Spanish is servicial. You're supposed to be of service to others in every way that you can. So I guess that would probably be my strongest influence, because when you're raised with that, then you would always look for ways that you could help people. And then, of course, you know, being in the Girl Scouts also kind of reinforced that. And I was active in the church also. I sang in a choir, active in the church organizations. And so I guess that my life was sort of, I was an activist, growing up as an activist. When I was growing up, farm workers were actually getting paid pretty good wages during the war years, you know.
There's a change. Mm-hmm. We were down a short end.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 19, camera roll 20 is
really
next.
Good stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, videotape goes on and on. Roll in.
Camera roll 20, sound roll 9, take 2.
So we were talking about growing up in Stockton and about how service and being of service was mm-hmm. part of what you got from your family values. But even so, it's a big jump to having service as part of your life, to dedicating your life to serving another. And how did you get from being a cheerleader to actually start along the road to being an organizer?
Well, as I said before, I was kind of a, I belonged to church groups, and in Stockton there were other organizations that I belonged to. One of the groups was a group of women who would always have these dances, and then they would give charity baskets out, you know, for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and I just always felt that, you know, there should be more. So when I met Fred Ross, and, you know, he started talking about the... Well, before that, I had organized some youth groups. I had organized a couple of teenage groups just so that, that we would have some place to go without the police harassing us. And I had gotten in touch with some of the local city officials, or actually business people that gave us a place and gotten other people so that we could, you know, all we would have table tennis and have a jukebox for dancing and stuff of this nature. So I was always organizing people to do things. And the police shut down our youth center because they didn't want to see Chicanos and African-Americans and whites and Filipinos hanging around together, so they closed it down for no reason. That was the only reason, because we never had any alcohol or anything like that.
But so then in 1956 when this Anglo comes to town. Do you remember meeting Fred?
Since I was sort of an activist, I was also belonged to... I was always doing things in the community, you know what I mean? I was always belonging to different organizations that were doing things. I belonged to a group where we organized the Comisión Honorífica, which organized the 15th of September, Cinco de Mayo celebrations. So I already had a reputation as an activist, you know. And so when Fred Ross came to Stockton and he was organizing CSO, then I was one of the people that was invited to that meeting, to a house meeting, and that's where I met Fred. And of course, when Fred spelled out what CSO could do or what people could do if they got together, and this is, of course, something that I had been looking for all my life, because it's something, you know, I had been involved in a lot of different organizations to try to do something for the community, but they never did as much as I thought they should be done. So it was very, for me, I would say when Fred showed us pictures of people in Los Angeles that had come together, that had organized, that had, you know, fought the police and won, that had built health clinics, that had gotten people elected to office, I just felt like I had found a pot of gold. You know, if organizing could make this happen, then this is definitely something that I wanted to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. But connected with Fred was this other person that you started hearing about, Cesar. What did you first hear about Cesar?
Well, Fred would always tell us about this great organizer named Cesar Chavez, right? And so, of course, we were, you know, he was like the example. Fred would always, we were organizing our community, and we started doing the voter registration. And Fred would give us reports of things that were happening in other CSO chapters, different fights that different chapters were in, the Los Angeles chapter. And then he'd always mention that Cesar was, because Cesar and Fred Ross were the only two paid staff of the CSO. And so he would always give us reports about what Cesar was doing, you know, what he was doing in the San Jose area. So we knew him to be a really great organizer, because this is the way that Fred always described him.
Mm-hmm. And did he come over, and was there some sort of contact, personal contact, or was it just...
I didn't meet Cesar for a long time until after we already had our chapter in Stockton organized, and we were already doing our voter registration drive. And then Cesar was working, I believe, in Dakota or in San Jose, and they were going to be having the Oakland chapter of CSO. Or maybe it was the Oakland chapter they were organizing. They were going to have a dance, and so we went over to meet. They were having some kind of a fundraiser or something, so we went over to the people from Stockton, went over there, and that's where we met Cesar. But it was like Fred Ross introduced him to us, and then he disappeared. I mean, we saw him for about 5 seconds. This is Cesar Chavez, hello, and then he was gone. I mean, he just Cesar was very shy then, and he didn't, at least with people that he didn't know, I guess. But later on, when I saw him at various conventions, and then, you know, he always gave a very impressive report, and it sat down, and that was the end of Cesar. He would just give us a very impressive report. So it was actually from the time I started CSO, it was like a couple of years before I really got to know Cesar well. Or, you know, he was very private, and, you know, just wouldn't talk to anybody. I mean, at least not talk to us.
Towards the end of the decade, there's a move towards actually specifically organizing farm workers, and AWOC opens in Stockton in 59. And you, I suppose you were still in CSO, but you also got involved with that first AWOC operation.
Oh, better than that. I organized the two organizations. One of them was the Agricultural Workers Association. Under CSO, what we had done is set up with Ernesto Galarza. Well, let me back this up. We set up farm labor committees to deal with the problems of the farm workers, especially during the braceros. They had the braceros in those days. And Ernesto Galarza had been assigned, I guess he got some money from the Meat Cutters Union, to organize a farm workers. So Fred Ross brought Ernesto Galarza around to every CSO chapter, and then we were supposed to organize farm workers for Ernesto Galarza. So our chapter in Stockton organized, and I was like the head of the committee. We organized a group of farm workers, which we turned over to the Meat Cutters Union. But right after we turned them over, then they asked us not to come back to the meetings anymore. And then the group dissolved. So after that, I again started organizing another group called the AWA, the Agricultural Workers Association. And that one became a very, very large group. And I was organizing it. My then husband Ventura Huerta helped me, and my brother Marshall. So we went door to door. You know, I went to speak in all of the black churches. Went to the where all of the white farm workers lived. So we got a really, really large group together. I went and was looking for a Filipino leader, and everybody kept talking about Larry Itliong. So I went and I spoke to Larry Itliong to see if he would help us, and he said he would. So we really organized a very, very large group of farm workers. And once we had them all organized, then we contacted the AFL-CIO, and they sent a representative out. And that was what became AWOC. Mm-hmm. The group that we organized, which was the Agricultural Workers Association, called AWA.
But you...
When they were going to officially the AFL-CIO, after coming to our meeting and seeing how many people we had organized, then they decided to hire an organizer and to, you know, appropriate some money. Mm-hmm. And that became the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee. And the people, I was then the secretary, became the secretary of the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, and was also a staff person for AWOC. And the people, Norman Smith was sent out to be the director of it, and the people that they hired were the people that I recommended. And of course, Larry Itliong was one of the people that I recommended. But the other organizers were also people that I recommended, because they didn't really know anybody, because it came out of the group that we had organized, out of the AWA group. And that went along pretty well at the beginning. You know, we would send out all of the postcards, invite people to the meeting, but then they hired a guy named Lou Cranock, who decided that that wasn't the way to do it. And, there were a couple of big differences of opinion that we had. The first disagreement was that they decided to start sending out postcards to invite people to the meetings. So the first couple of meetings, I just took the machine home and sent the postcards out from my home to make sure that the people came to the meeting. But then they decided, no, that they weren't going to do that anymore. The second decision that they made was that they were going to start working with labor contractors. And what they would do is, like, a family would go out there and they would take a dollar from each family, which was supposed to be, quote, dues, right? But they weren't getting any kinds of benefits. And, of course, the workers hated the labor contractors. But I walked into the office one day and they had all these labor contractors, all of these crooks, you know, in the union office. And I got very upset about it, right? Then the other thing that finally, I decided that this, I wasn't going to hang, you know, was not going to continue with, to be the secretary of, or a staff person of the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, is that I was trying to get them to bring Caesar up, because Caesar had been very successful in having some strikes with the braceros in the Oxnard area. And so that Caesar could come up and just give everybody, you know, the guidance on the organizing that he was doing in Oxnard. And they didn't want to. And the reason they didn't want to is because they were just very threatened and very jealous of what Cesar was doing. And so, you know, I couldn't get any support, from Galarza or Father McDonald or any of the other people, Norman Smith, the other people that were on the committee. None of them would support me on that. So that's when I decided to leave, because I felt that it wasn't going to go anywhere at that point. It was, the meetings were getting smaller. They were no longer really interested in organizing the workers. What they were doing is they were deducting dues to send to the AFL-CIO to make it look like they had some kind of organization. But it was really coercion, because the labor contractors were deducting the dues and the workers had no say over it.
But even then, when you tried to work with AWOC and you suggested that Caesar had come and chosen what he was doing, was it clear, did you have a sense that Caesar was on the right track then, that there would be another way to organize farm workers? I mean, similar to the way you'd been working too?
The way that Cecil and I both worked in organizing farm workers was the way that we had been taught by Fred Ross, you know, to organize from the bottom up, you know, through house meetings to get people together, to keep people participating. And that's what Cecil was doing. And what AWOC was doing was just exactly the opposite. They were just going to work through the foreman. Now, in the Filipino community, I have to modify this, because among the Filipinos, it worked differently. The Filipino crew leaders worked differently than the other labor contractors, because they would negotiate for the workers. They set up their own kitchens, you know. So the Filipino crew leaders were more like representatives of the workers, right? And they had a whole different type of a relationship than, say, the Latino labor contractors or the white labor contractors.
Well, okay, we got to change.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I want to say this is because, you know, Larry stayed with.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 20. Yeah. Camera roll 21 is next. Our next take is take three. Three, sorry. Beating.
Camera roll 21, sound roll 9, take 3.
Okay, let's start over on what you're saying about the Filipino villagers.
Larry had operated as a crew leader, and so that what they were trying to do with AWOC probably worked out good with Filipino crews, because they did have some kind of representation through the crew leader system, which is very different from the Latino or the whites. So Larry and I, after I left, Larry Itlong and I kept our relationship, you know, going, since I'm the one that had first gotten him into help us organize AWA, and also got the EWC to hire him. You know, we kept our relationship strong. And, you know, we kept in CSO, I continued working for CSO and continued to help farm workers. And then when we started our union, the National Farm Workers Association, Larry and I kept that our communications always strong. So, and that was very important, because when it came down to the time of merger between our independent union and AWOC, it was Larry and I who were able to bridge that gap. And although Al Green, who later on replaced Norman Smith, was very hostile to Cecil and myself, it was that relationship that I had with Larry that we kept that going. Larry, by the way, had also joined CSO, or had to join CSO, because our initial organizing was of AWA was primarily started with CSO members, so he was also a member of CSO.
Well, let's before we get to the founding of
that. That's not a helicopter.
No, that's it.
It's
okay. Yeah.
That's a commercial plane.
But let's talk about still getting ready to where you. Mm-hmm. There's this break in 1962. Were you and Caesar thinking about? I mean, I know at a certain point Caesar became the national head of CSO, and
he was the director. Yeah, he wasn't an elected official.
But the way at what point did that start to coalesce that what you really the goal was to organize farm workers?
Well, that Cesar had been working on organizing farm workers, and what I had been doing in Stockton, organizing farm workers. And that was like my big priority, and that was his big priority. And he had also organized a large group of farm workers in Oxnard, which he turned over to the Packing House Workers Union. And that organization had the same fate as the groups that I had organized in Stockton. When we turned them over, they dissolved. So, we both had tried to work within the AFL-CIO structure at that time and saw that it wasn't going to make it. So that's at that point. What we were working on was to start organizing farm workers, but to do it under the CSO, and to do like a pilot project. And Caesar was going to do that in Oxnard. He didn't want CSO to pay him though. What he wanted to do is want to work out some procedure where the workers would have to pay him, something like a dues structure, but it would be under the auspices of CSO, and that's what we thought was going to happen. Yeah, we met with the whole executive board of the CSO, and I should say not the whole executive board, but at least the people that were in California, and they approved the project. Alinsky came out. He thought it was a good idea. Of course, Fred Ross was totally with Cesar and myself. You know, we kept planning how we were going to do this. But then when we went to the convention, people like Tony Rios, who was then the president of CSO, and they didn't support us. In fact, it was just the opposite. They talked against it at the convention and organized against it. So when the vote came for the CSO to support this pilot project to form a union, it was voted down at the convention. And at that point, that's when Cecil got up and left. He resigned, and he stood up.
You want to stop the train?
It's okay for a few minutes.
Okay. Did you know that that was sort of the option there, that if they didn't go through, Cesar was ready to leave?
Oh, right. No, he had already said if the CSO doesn't...
Okay, let's stop.
That was pre-planned.
Yeah. Let's just talk a little more about the convention. Or CSO decides not to do it. You were saying that you and Cesar had discussed what the options were going to be if they supported her.
Yeah, Cesar had already decided that, you know, if the convention was not going to support our plan, and then we were going to do it without the CSO. The decision had been made that we're going to start a union, and the initial plan was we'll do it under CSO, but then also that if CSO did not approve it, that we would do it without them. So, when we went to convention. And the officers actually spoke against, Tony Rios spoke against the project, and the delegates voted it down. Of course, we were really hurt and disappointed, very hurt and very disappointed, because we thought that we might be able to get them to approve it. But nevertheless, because we knew it would be a lot harder doing it without CSO, because CSO already had a very favorable reputation throughout the state, a lot of political backing. The labor unions all back CSO, the religious groups, a lot of the politicians, because we were very active politically. We had passed some very major legislation, and so it was a big disappointment. But looking back, it was probably the best thing that ever happened. So at that convention, they voted the project down, then Cesar got up and he resigned. And of course, nobody believed him. He got up and said, I just want to submit my resignation. And Tony Rios, took the podium and said, of course, he says, we're not going to accept his resignation, right? And then delegates got up from the floor and they said, no, we don't accept his resignation. And then what could they do? And Cesar never said another word. He never said why, or he just said, And it was kind of a very significant day.
Now, you talked about CSO having had all that support, including church support, and I know that you met Chris Hartmeyer during that period in mm-hmm. the migrant ministry. Mm-hmm. Was there any indication that if you left and worked independently that there would be church support?
No, there wasn't. I mean, we were starting. In fact, the decision that we made is that we would work very quietly until we built our base of farm workers before we would even go to the outside. So the only persons from the outside that were helping us were Fred Ross and my father, who used to send us money. And Cesar didn't solicit money either. There was a woman in Oxnard that wanted to give Cesar a big amount of money, but Cesar didn't want to take it because he felt that the money had to come from the workers, because it had to be a bona fide union. The money had to come from the bottom. So he really wouldn't. Didn't solicit any outside help. The one, interestingly enough, for the record, that Fred asked Olinsky to help, and Olinsky refused. And Fred was very hurt by that. And he told Olinsky, and I was with him when he asked him, he said, Saul, he says, you've supported everything from the Civil War in Spain to all of these other organizations, and you mean you're not going to support Cesar? And Olinsky said, no, he said, because it's never going to, he indicated it was going to be a failed project, that it was never going to be successful. So I guess if you look around at who had faith in what was going to happen, Fred Ross was the only one that had the faith.
Well, Fred was a pretty key individual, wasn't he, in terms of both your life and Cesar's life and that?
Yeah, and at the beginning, though, Fred really wasn't involved at the very beginning. It was, he didn't come back into the picture because he took a job in Rochester, New York, I believe. It was at one of the universities there. To teach organizing. So the contact that we had with Fred was mostly through correspondence or he would get the contribution that he gave every month.
But when you look at his contribution over his whole lifetime.
Then Fred came back into the When he came back in was after the first march to Sacramento in 1966, when we marched to Sacramento, and then we got our first contract with Shenley. And then Fred flew out, you know, at the end of the march, and then Sisson met with him and asked him to come and start working with us. But, of course, also we had no money, you know, so we couldn't pay Fred at the beginning. You know, we didn't have any money at all. You know, we were just barely living on the little bit that we could get. Then by the time we had that first march to Sacramento, then we were already in talks with, and we were already having talks to merge with the AFL-CIO.
Well, that's jumping ahead a little bit. I want to switch gears right now and talk about that early period from 62 to 65, and your what it took on your part to be able to become an organizer and what it meant and basically what you did was a relatively unusual thing for a Mexican American woman. There's not a lot of precedent for leaving the home and going out and you gained the respect of women. Talk about your role as a woman in this process.
Well, I guess going back again to CSO, you know what I mean? Using that community organizing structure where, you know, people from the community can become activists, you know. My mother was very active in CSO, and I was very active. I got my aunts involved. You know, we wanted to get everybody to help. So that there were a lot of women who were involved in as being activists in CSO. When I decided to work full time, then that was a little difficult because I had been working as a teacher, and people thought I was a little loony because I was also going through a divorce, and so yeah, I had 7 children, and was going to quit my job teaching to come to organize a union. So that people thought that was a little strange. You know, and got a lot of pressure too, you know, for not to do that. That I shouldn't do that.
But you know, I mean, you're a modest person, I think, but you're a very unique person as a woman to achieve that leadership. You know, it's one thing being involved; it's another thing to really.
Well, I think I was very fortunate again because I was raised by my mother. I mean, you know, my mother had always been a leader. She was.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm drink some water. I'm getting
a little nervous.
Okay, that's the end of Cameral 21 and the end of these sound rolls, too.